Hi, everybody. Today's Monday, July 14th, 2025, and our friend Colonel Jacques Beau is back with us. Welcome back, Colonel.
Thank you very much for inviting me again. Thanks.
Colonel, here is what Donald Trump said in terms of, it seems that today he's going to announce something big as he was talking about before. And here is what he said about the policy of the United States toward Ukraine.
With the Secretary General is coming in tomorrow. But we basically are going to send them various pieces of very sophisticated military. And they're going to pay us 100% for them. And that's the way we want it. And we've been trying to get that again. I don't think Biden ever asked for it. We're in for about $350 billion. Europe is in for $100 billion. That's a lot of money, $100. But they should be in actually for more than us. So, as we send equipment, they're going to reimburse us for that equipment. Doesn't that sound good? That's the way it should have been a long time ago. I haven't agreed on the number yet, but they're going to have some because they do need protection. But the European Union is paying for it. We're not paying anything for it, but we will send it. It'll be business for us, and we will send them Patriots, which they desperately need because Putin really surprised a lot of people. He talks nice, and then he bombs everybody in the evening. There's a little bit of a problem there, and I don't like it.
And here is what Lindsey Graham said, Colonel. He said that the United States has reached a turning point regarding Russia. Watch for the plan under which America will begin selling a massive amount of weapons to our European allies, weapons that could benefit Ukraine. And who's going to pay for these weapons, as Donald Trump pointed out, is the European Union or European countries. And what's going on in your opinion? Macron is talking about doubling the military budget. Merz, the Chancellor of Germany, is talking about they're all in to support Ukraine. Where are we headed when you look at the situation in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, if you talk about what Macron said, he announced already months ago that he would try to double the defense budget. But it's not a surprise. I mean, in 2023, France spent 1.9% of its GDP for defense. Now, it has committed to go up to 5% in the recent NATO summit. So there is no real surprise there. The problem is that we don't understand why we need to have this expanding defense budget. Now, what was decided in NATO recently was a 5% defense budget, as I said. But in those 5%, in fact, 3.5% is devoted to national defense. And 1.5% should be devoted to collective defense. And collective defense has not really been defined properly. And in fact, most people put under this collective defense the support provided to Ukraine, because the idea or the rationale being that Ukraine is protecting Europe from a Russian invasion. So Ukraine is blocking Russia, and therefore helping Ukraine is in fact having some kind of collective defense of Europe. And therefore, that's the rationale for the 1.5%. And that's not just for France, it's for all the NATO members. So there is no surprise that we have an increase in defense. The problem is, why should we do that now and what for? Because what we see now is that the idea, and Donald Trump is the smartest, because he turned the conflict into a business, that was already apparent with the infamous rare earth or strategic mineral deal that was suggested initially by Volodymyr Zelensky end of last year, because Zelensky understood that having Trump as a president in the US would mean that the US would have less interest in supporting financially Ukraine. Therefore, the idea of Zelensky was to, in fact, wake this interest by saying to Trump, okay, you want an interest in supporting Ukraine, so I sell you some areas where you have rare earth and all that, and therefore you will have a national interest in supporting Ukraine. That was the idea. And therefore the idea was to have this deal in exchange of future support, weapon support and financial support to Ukraine. The problem is that Trump didn't see the problem that way. He said, okay, for the minerals, but not as a payment for future support, but in payment as past support. And therefore, he made the deal. And eventually, you had different iteration of this deal. And now there is a new iteration, although I'm not sure this is still valid, because as the Russians are proceeding in Ukraine, I'm not sure this deal has still some kind of validity. But the point is that Trump understood that instead of being a black hole where the US put money in, the Ukraine could be a source of income. And that's exactly what we are seeing now with this equipment, which is sold to Ukraine and sold to the Europeans so that they can give it to Ukraine. So he has literally turned a conflict into a business, which is, I mean, that's Trump, basically. So no real surprise. The problem is that in Europe, as you rightly said or asked, where does the money come from? And that's the big question, because if you take the example of France will double its budget, but when it goes from 1.9% of the GDP to 5% of the GDP, that means you have to take the money somewhere. And the answer is, in fact, already there. And I remind you what Mark Rutte said in December last year, and namely that the European countries should spend less on social matter and things like this, and devote the money or part of the money devoted to social security, pension, health, and social and things like this to defense. So that's where the European countries will get the money from, and that's extremely strange in countries that have in fact built their national system, their social system, on the state, I mean the state assistance. So we are definitely changing, the world is changing in that way, and that will have a direct impact on European populations. If you look at, for instance, the countries that have the highest defense budget in Europe today, these are the countries that are also the poorest countries in Europe. I mean, if you look at the GDP per capita in Eastern Europe, what Donald Rumsfeld used to call the New Europe, and namely the Baltic States and Poland, those countries who are adamant to support a US policy, and they were the first one to support George W. Bush in its adventure in Iraq and Afghanistan and all that. These countries, they are very ready to spend a lot of money on defense, but at the same time, these are the countries that are have the smallest among the smallest GDPs in Europe. So there are a lot of questions to ask there, because definitely we put money into something that is just or the only rationale for this money is kind of a fantasy type of threat, because we know exactly the reason why Russia has started this offensive in Ukraine in February 2022. It has nothing to do with the occupation of Ukraine or invading Europe or extending Russia or whatever. But this is, in essence, it is a local conflict, in essence. It was made international because the West, especially Europe, tried to intervene in a conflict and have an active part in the conflict in different under different form. But the thing is that we have, in essence, a local conflict that has been developed into an international, even a global conflict because of all the sanctions and everything that has been done, the problem of oils and gas and all that. But in essence, it's a local conflict. The problem is that the narrative in Europe, especially, and in the West in general, was essentially that the rationale behind the Russian intervention was the Russian expansionism. I mean, the idea of make this Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, even the Soviet Union, some said. So we are in this idea that the Russians have kind of revanchist type of behavior, and in fact are dying to invade the rest of Europe. Now, if you look at this from a military point of view, probably Russia has the military means and resources to push forward towards Paris or Berlin or wherever. Maybe. But the problem is then, what then? What is the objective of that? Is that just Putin's hubris? That he just wants to be in Paris and be on the Eiffel Tower? Or what is the objective? There is no stated objective of this threat. And you mentioned Macron, but 2 days ago, you had the chief of the French Joint Chief of Staff in some way. This is the l'état-major des armées. This is the high joint army staff, we can say. This is the head of the French armed forces in peacetime. And this guy said that France was the primary target of Russia. Where does it get that from? I mean, why? Why would Russia be so anxious to attack France? For what? It's a country that is in permanent deficit, has incredible societal problems with minorities that are poorly integrated, where you have increasing economic problems and increasing debt. So what's the purpose of going all the way from Moscow to Paris just for what? To have a nice parade in the Champs-Élysées with just Russian forces? I mean, you see, it doesn't make any sense. And that's where you see that when you state that France is the primary target of Russia, it has the sole purpose of justifying the increasing defense budget, and it has also as a secondary objective is to make acceptable to the French population that money will be distracted from social spending into military spending. That's the only purpose. But how can you accept that as a citizen? I mean, that's beyond a common understanding, because we see absolutely not the slightest indication that Russia has the capacity probably to attack, but it has not the capacity to occupy France and Western Europe, because when you reach Paris, that means you have to occupy Germany, you have to occupy all the Eastern European countries and all that. So it requires millions of soldiers. Does Russia have that? What's the idea behind this? In addition to the fact that we don't see any objective. And here we have something that is quite important, because all these narratives that we have seen since the very beginning of this the Russian military operation, the objectives were clearly defined by Vladimir Putin. And these objectives were, in fact, they were announced on the 24th February 2022, and there were two: demilitarization and denazification. And they were both related to the situation that was experienced by the Russian population in Ukraine, period. That's the objective fact. But now we have developed additional objectives, like taking Kiev in 2 days, occupy Ukraine, attacking Europe, and. We keep developing Russian objectives, but that comes from the West, not from Russia. And that reflects something which is quite concerning, especially if you look at it from a military point of view, is that the West is used to wage wars without clear objectives. We wage tactical wars. We kill people. We don't exactly know why and what for, but just we kill them. That's the thing. That's why when we go to Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Sahel, wherever, we don't solve problems. We just create additional problems. And that's, talking about France, this was one of my criticisms. I talked to many officers. I know many officers who have been committed to the Sahel region in the Barkhane operation against the jihadi and so on in that region. But they all came with the same comment. They said, well, we fight, but we don't know exactly what we want to achieve. So there is no objective. And when you don't have an objective, you cannot have a strategy, because the strategy is nothing else than the way you want to achieve your objective or you reach the objective. So no objective, no strategy, meaning that you are bound to a tactical war. And that's exactly what's happening, or what was happening in Ukraine, or still happening in Ukraine. And that was part of the criticism that was made by the Ukrainians themselves, Zelensky in particular, but also Ukrainian officers, who said, well, the training we received in France and Germany is just tactical. Because those officers don't know, I mean, the French officers, and they don't understand the kind of war we are waging in Ukraine. So basically, you can train soldiers, but you cannot train units or battalions and things like that for warfare, because you don't understand this warfare. But what we see today go beyond that, because since we wage war without objective, then we don't need to elaborate an objective for Putin to attack the West. We assume he does exactly as we do, fighting without an objective. Because that's the rhetoric we have developed since the beginning of this conflict in Ukraine. And this is shocking, because that means that instead of having a sound, solid, robust analysis of what's going on in the field in order to adjust even the support we provide to Ukraine, but also to adjust our own militaries and our own armies and defense systems and all that, in order to cope with a possible future war somewhere, sometime, we don't know what we are preparing for. We spend money, we decide to spend 5%. But what exactly for? What do we need now? More tanks, more drones, more aircraft, more this, more that. We don't know. Because we don't even understand what a potential enemy would try to do if he attacks Europe. During the Cold War, even if we were in fact wrong about this, but the thing is that the common wisdom at that time was that Soviet Union would attack the West because it was a process, a historic process of progressive forces against conservative forces, and they would attack West Europe in order to impose Marxism, communism, or whatever we had, depending on the vocabulary. We were wrong on this, by the way. That was the assumption. That was, as I said, the agreed wisdom at that time, but it happened that it didn't happen precisely. But at least there was a rationale. At least we are preparing our armed forces for something. And even if our assumption were wrong, we had a concrete model to fight against. We knew how was the Soviet army, what they wanted to achieve, or we assumed what they wanted to achieve, and we prepared for that. Probably if we would have a war, we would probably have not be in the probably would have not be the right preparation. But anyway, at least we had something to base on. Here we have absolutely nothing. We don't know exactly why the Russians would like to attack the West. Is that to impose an ideology? If yes, which one? Because Russia has, in fact, today exactly the same economic or political ideology as we have in Europe, essentially. So what would they like to impose? Is that just because they want to impose the Russian language? I mean, so much effort just for that. I mean, you see, we don't know what exactly we are preparing for. And that shows this kind of irrationality that we have seen since more than 3 years now in Europe regarding this conflict. At least, even if Trump, I'm not sure he understands better the conflict than the Europeans do, at least he has understood that this conflict is a black hole where you just put money in and you have no return on investment. And nothing good come out of this. At the end of the day, the situation of Ukraine is worsening every day. And we don't know exactly how we can restore some kind of Ukrainian success or have achieved any kind of Ukrainian success. We don't know exactly if we achieve success. How do we define success? How do we define victory over Russia? How do we define defeat of Ukraine? We don't know all that. So we just put money without any hope of investment, of a return on investment. And therefore, it's a lose-lose situation from the West. And I think Trump instinctively has understood that. And that's something, this is a merit we can give to him. But the problem is that he's not a strategist, meaning that he understands that helping Ukraine doesn't lead anywhere. But at the same time, he doesn't know how to solve the problem. He tried we have discussed that many times on your channel with Keith Kellogg, his project, and but we know that the various attempts of Trump to impose a US-made solution is a no-go. So we have to find something else. And so far, the US administration has not been able to produce something better, because we are still reluctant to listen to the Russians. We understand they are winning. We see that they are winning. We understand that we are not able to help Ukraine in order to reverse the course of the war. But we don't want to listen to them. As a result, we are in a situation where we know that it can only worsen, and we keep under supporting Ukraine. It's just insane, this situation.
Yeah, Carl, here is what we had in New York Times after the many things happening in Gaza. They're talking about how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. I would assume that the case is the same for the Europeans. They're trying to continue the conflict in Ukraine because many of these European leaders are in some sort of weak position in their countries. That's why they need to continue the war in Ukraine, because as Donald Trump pointed out, they're going to send Patriot systems, weapons to Ukraine. But how is that going to help Ukraine? Here is what the Ukrainian army is talking about, that 70% of mobilized Ukrainians will soon desert. They're going to leave the army. These are those people who've been mobilized to the army. You see something that you look at it, that there is no viable choice for Ukraine to continue the conflict. On the other hand, Europeans are insisting on sending more weapons to Ukraine, while the United States, we know that, as you mentioned, Donald Trump is turning the situation into a business. Go ahead and your take on that.
Well, the thing is that, as you're absolutely right, if you look at the leaders that are promoting war today or promoting the idea of supporting and that's what Emmanuel Macron, by the way, said just yesterday or so, that they should support Ukraine up to the end, and there is no, we'll not miss that and things like this. Macron, Friedrich Merz, and Keir Starmer, these are the three big countries of the so-called old Europe, as Donald Rumsfeld will say. But they're also the weakest in terms of economy. I mean, all of them have a degrading economy with increasing debt, with increasing social problems, with the largest probably gap between the so-called elite that are ruling the country and the population. And you have more and more opposition coming, not simply right versus left or things like this. It's a horizontal problem, meaning it's the basis, the population, the grassroots population versus the elite. And you have that in all the three countries. And all the three countries, it's very fascinating to see that when you listen to their political addresses, they don't have political addresses or comment about the situation in their own country. They focus systematically on conflicts that are outside of the country. And that was noted by for Keir Starmer, Friedrich Merz, and Emmanuel Macron. All the three, they seem to pay more attention to the conflict that are outside the country rather than the situation inside the country. It's quite odd, but it's also understandable. This is something we have seen on many occasions, that that was something that was also suggested as the behavior of George W. Bush in 2001 as he started the global war on terror, because he had not been able to make the situation better in the US. So he found an external theater of war in order to achieve some kind of success. And we have exactly the same thing here, that you try to distract the opinion of your population in order to achieve some kind of success. I mean, and the word success should be put in quotation marks, because we don't really know how to define the word success. But I think for them, creating a problem for Russia is a success. That's probably the way we should define success for them. In any case, they pay more attention to that than the the conflict that the internal or domestic situation in their country. And by the way, we see a lot of effort to support Ukraine. We see much less effort in trying to solve the situation in the Middle East, for instance, because that's a situation where they feel very uncomfortable. All these countries were countries that, to some degree, are in fact profoundly, profoundly anti-Semitic. But they don't want to say it. Therefore, they don't want to support the Palestinians. But at the same time, you know, being against the Palestinian, then, of course, they would be qualified as anti-Semitic and all that. So they don't do that. So it's a very, very tricky situation there. And so they don't do anything. And that shows how our leadership is not based on values, first of all, is not based on the international law. Just to remind you that Finland, Baltic states, and Poland just withdrew from the Ottawa Convention on Anti-Personnel Mines. So that just shows that this kind of value doesn't belong to the vocabulary in Europe anymore. They don't even fight for the application of the law. Remember how the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was celebrated as it issued the arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin. ICC was celebrated. Now it issued an arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu. Nobody talks about ICC anymore. In fact, we put sanctions now on ICC. So this is totally incoherent. It's the total absence of consistency, the total absence of morale, the total absence of ethics in politics, domestic as foreign policy, shows that we are in a situation where, in fact, we are failing and we are bound to fail, because this is not sustainable. You see, this is not sustainable. So we have here a situation where we'll continue probably to help Ukraine, but at the same time we help Ukraine because we have a big brother, namely the U.S. We have money, but we don't have the weapons. Therefore, we buy money to the U.S. and we send them to Ukraine. That's the model. But there is, at the same time, there is absolutely not the slightest effort to find another solution to the conflict. We don't know of how this will end on the battlefield, and most probably with some kind of decisive victory, or I don't know, from the decisive Russian victory. We don't know exactly how big will be this victory and if it happened, or we have no idea. But it seems that the Western leadership tries to hope that there will be a solution on the battlefield. But politically, they are not in a position to anticipate what will happen, because what will happen is certainly not a Ukrainian victory. Certainly not. And the common sense would say that since you anticipate that the situation will worsen for Ukraine, that you probably try to find a political situation. And therefore, you talk to Russia. But if you talk to Russia, you don't talk as Macron did. That means we have a solution and you have to accept our solution. I mean, even if they don't have a solution, because in fact, the West, beyond asking for a ceasefire, they have no solution. And the ceasefire is not a solution. And that's a difference with the Russians, because the Russians said, well, the ceasefire is part of the solution. It's not the solution. And therefore, we have first to elaborate or have a negotiation in order to elaborate a solution. And the ceasefire will be part of this, but not the other the other way around. The problem is the West has absolutely no idea of how to solve the problem. And they don't want to accept the Russian position, even if the Russians, since they are victorious, I mean, they are successful, let's put that way, on the battlefield. Logic and common sense would say that probably we have to listen to them and probably to find an agreement with listening to their position and not to other position of outsiders. But they don't want to do so. And that was very clear with what Emmanuel Macron said, and we have what we know from the conversation he had with Vladimir Putin. He tried to impose a solution, as Donald Trump did. So we come with our own solution, and we say, take it or leave it. So the Russians say, leave it. That's it. It's as simple as that. I'm winning, so I don't care. If you don't have a solution, you will be forced to a solution. And that's exactly the problem, that slowly the Westerners are pushing Ukraine in a situation where it cannot avoid a political solution. Because we know that the Russians don't want to occupy the whole of Ukraine. They certainly don't want to occupy the western part of Ukraine, where you have the most hardcore nationalists and things like this. So they don't want to do that. They have experience as Soviet Union that this is a region that continued to fight after World War II up to the early 60s. In that region, where you had come guerrilla warfare and terrorist acts and things like this. So the Russians don't want to experience that again, meaning that they certainly don't want to occupy the whole of Ukraine. They may continue to occupy areas. I can probably look at the map so that it's probably a bit more explicit for. If we look at a map, we have here exactly up to date, but roughly that's where the Russian forces are today in Ukraine, and that might be the extension that Russia might want to reach, which this area, which includes the four the famous four oblasts, Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, and Lugansk. In addition to that, you have Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnipropetrovsk, and Kharkov. And all that, all this area here with these eight oblasts is what the Russians call Novorossiya, which is an historic name for the region. So we may have the Russians reaching that limit and try to have to occupy this territory and to keep those territory. It's very unlikely they would like to go into the western part of the country because, as I said, it's difficult. So that means that there will be a point of balance somewhere as the Russians will reach between here and here. That means in that area, when the Russians reach this area, you will have a point of balance where the two parties will have a vital interest to negotiate. And that's probably what the Russians are trying to do, pressing the Ukraine into a negotiation process. The problem is that the more the Ukrainians wait, the less territory they will have. But we probably have as I said, a point of balance here along this line, or probably a little bit before, where both parties have an interest to have a negotiated solution. Because the full occupation of Ukraine, in my view, at least, I might be wrong on this, but in my view, the complete occupation of Ukraine is not a solution that is preferred by the Russians. In fact, the Russians would like to avoid this. So we are moving toward a solution where the Ukrainians will have no choice. they will have no choice at all. And the West will have no choice either, because they will be constrained to accept the negotiation. And since we don't know exactly up to which point the Russians want to proceed,
You mentioned that Russia is not interested in the western part of Ukraine, but it seems that the Europeans, together somehow with the United States and the administration in Ukraine, they're trying to do everything to drag Russia into the western part of Ukraine, because they see somehow Russia, it's going to be a quagmire for Russia.
Well, that's possible. I mean, that's possible. Again, the problem is, that raised the question of the morality of all this. Because assuming that what you suggest is correct, that means that the West is in fact sacrificing Ukraine just for the sake of creating a problem for Russia. In fact, it's the case since 2014, in reality. This problem could have had a solution with the Minsk Agreement 1 and 2 since February 2015. We could have a solution. The West didn't want a solution because they want to create a problem for Russia. But I mean, to be honest, this is probably what some Westerners think, but I hope it's not the case, because that would be an amorality of tremendous importance, that you are ready to sacrifice a country just for the sake of creating a problem for another, not even winning over the other, but just create a problem for him. So that shows kind of a cold-blooded approach of the conflict that I'm reluctant to accept, that even the most cold-blooded European wants to do that. It might be the case, by the way. You might be right. But I prefer to refuse that option and refuse that some people think about this, because that would show a profound immorality in the European polity. And that's something it sounds something extremely disturbing to me, to be honest. So I hope it's not the case. But assuming we go into that direction, that's probably what will happen. Remember that 2 years ago, Medvedev published a map of what Ukraine might be after the conflict. And in fact, he showed a Ukraine that was severely reduced, with the whole western part, I mean the far western, if we go back to the map just to show a little bit the situation. This part here, that is strongly Hungarian, that might return to Hungary. This part here, which is Romanian, ethnically Romanian, could return to Romania. This part here, which is the Galicia, is strongly of Polish extraction. Poland may want to retrieve this area. We will have the Russian-speaking part. In fact, it's Novorossiya, plus maybe some oblasts here, meaning that what would remain of the current Ukraine would be, in fact, the central part. This is this part here around Kiev that would remain as an independent state. The rest would be returned to where they belonged before World War II. So we may end up with a solution like this. That's a possibility. But again, as I said, I think the Russians don't want to go beyond. My personal view is that they don't really want to go beyond the Dnieper, especially in the northern part. In the southern part, in order to take again or retake Odessa and probably Nikolaev, I think they could cross the Dnieper. But in the northern part of the country, they probably want to avoid this. And therefore, that will be a situation where we might have a negotiation before we reach that point. I think that's what will happen, because I cannot, let's say, I'm very, how to say that, skeptical about the idea of the Europeans making or leaving Ukraine completely occupied by Russia, even if you have a guerrilla warfare or something like that, that eventually will create a problem for Russia. I'm not sure the Europeans want to do that. So they will find certainly a moment where they will understand the need for negotiating. And we are probably not far away from that point, because as I mentioned, the call between Emmanuel Macron and Vladimir Putin last week. And this call didn't come as an initiative from Macron. In fact, it's the fact that in the European Union, people start to understand that probably we should open a dialogue with Russia. And that was raised already in February and March this year. And there is something going on in Europe, because they understand that, of course, we need to support Ukraine, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, we see that everything we do is just prolonging the war. It's not solving the problem. It's just prolonging the problem. And therefore, with time goes, we'll probably have more pressure within the European Union and within the West at large to have a negotiated solution. Again, the critical aspect of that is that if we have a negotiated solution, we have to understand that the Russians are winning, and therefore we will have to take their position into consideration. We cannot come to the negotiation and imposing a solution as it was the case, you remember, exactly 1 year ago, when you had the conference in Switzerland, the Bürgenstock conference, which was supposed to be a peace conference, where in fact the idea was that Ukraine would present and the international community would accept or to validate the Ukrainian 10 points plan of Volodymyr Zelensky, which in essence asks for a capitulation of Russia. That was exactly 1 year ago. And the Ukrainian position since then has not changed very much, meaning that if we go towards a negotiated solution, I don't see any prospect for the Zelensky plan to be accepted in any way. The problem is that the Europeans have to acknowledge that, to understand that, and to work out an alternative position in order to engage into negotiation with a position that is constructive. I mean, that can lead to somewhere, because what we have seen, in fact, in Istanbul, early June this year, we have the Russians. They have elaborated their plan based on what Vladimir Putin said exactly. No, not exactly, because we are in July, and that was the 14th of June, 2024. What he said exactly at that point, with the two basic conditions, no NATO and the four oblasts returning to Russia. In any case, that the Russians have elaborated on that and presented that in Istanbul. On the other side, the Ukrainians have continued on their own track without considering in any way that the Russians were winning on a battlefield. So to some extent, we can probably argue whether the Russian demand are maximalist and all that, but at least they are consistent with the situation on the battlefield. While the Ukrainian position is not only beyond the point, but they're totally disconnected for any kind of reality on the ground. So I think the major intellectual step that must be taken by the West at large, Ukraine in particular, and with the Europeans, is to elaborate position that takes into account the reality on the ground and to take into account what the Russians want, and to elaborate a few points that can probably be discussed between Ukrainians and Russians in order to see how this any agreement can be acceptable for both. But what has been achieved on the ground by the Russian forces is, in my view, cannot be challenged politically at this stage. It could have been, at one point it was challenged, because in April 2022, the Russians agreed to withdraw all their forces from Ukraine in exchange of the non-membership of NATO and things like this. But they were ready to remove all their troops from Ukraine. And they also withdrew their forces from the area of Kiev as a sign of goodwill, at the request of Germany and France, by the way. So the Russians at one point were ready to give up, or not to give up, but to say, okay, we have reached that, we have gained this territory on the battlefield, but we are ready to give that back to Ukraine in exchange of something. The problem is that since then, the Ukrainians have been so dishonest in many ways by making promises and not realizing them, and with the support of the Europeans to make those attacks on Russian soil and all that. So now the Russians have probably not the slightest willingness to give back the territory they are occupying. So by acting as it did, Ukraine in fact closed the door to any return of those territories that are currently occupied by Russia. And Russia is in a position to enforce that. So why should they walk back? Because they are in a position to enforce their demand. And that's the reality Ukraine and the West should realize, and to, as I said, to elaborate a position that is negotiable for the Russians. I think that's the more or less where we are. We should head to. The problem is that, do we have enough wisdom in the Western leadership to accept that? Not yet. We accept now the idea that probably we will have to talk to the Russians, but we haven't realized yet how to talk to the Russians and what can we offer to the Russians and how can we attract them into a negotiation where, given the situation, both sides can win something, given the situation. Meaning that, again, the territories are, in my view, they're probably lost for Ukraine. But given that situation, if you negotiate, there is still wins possible. Not the decisive win you with the flag on the Reichstag in Berlin or something like that. We're not talking about this kind of win. But the win in the sense that the stopping the war is for both sides a benefit, because this war is bleeding both countries. In my view, it's bleeding Ukraine much more than Russia. But this is my personal view. Again, we should have the real facts and figures in order to decide this. But in any case, regardless how we see it, this is certainly bleeding both countries. And here we could have a win-win situation. Simply stopping fighting is already a win-win, in fact. Let's be honest. Even if you lose territory, the fact that you don't lose more lives, it's already a win. And this is becoming critical for Ukraine. You know, recently I saw some interview of Ukrainians here in Belgium. And they are here since 3 years or so. By the way, a lot of those Ukrainians are following me on YouTube. You know, this is very interesting. And they came to me to congratulate me and to thank me, even if for a lot of people I have a more like pro-Russian type of position. Which I don't, I'm nothing to do with Russia, but my position, as my realistic position about the conflict, in fact, may be interpreted as pro-Russian. In any case, a lot of Ukrainians here in Belgium have come, I mean, I saw them on a sidewalk in the street, and they come and thank me for what I said. So that's just to say. But in an interview of such a Ukrainian refugee, he said, well, there is no way we'll return to Ukraine. Now, we have been inserted in the society here. Some have married, some have a job, some have opened a business. So there is no rationale for them to go back in a country that has been destroyed, where you have a political power that is still very, let's say, dubious, let's put it that way, in terms of human rights and all that. That's another topic. But I mean, this is not to me to make this judgment, but in any case, this is not an incentive for Ukrainians to go back to the country. And therefore, meaning that those who have left Ukraine, only a fraction of them will come back to Ukraine. If you add to this all who have died, who are probably exactly in this age where the age you need to rebuild the country, you know, what are you doing after the conflict? And in order to stop the bleeding of your vital forces in the country, negotiating is probably not a bad option in the situation, given that the fact that you cannot do better, you will not reverse the situation. You can probably destroy more drones and missiles. That's it. And you probably kill a few soldiers on the front line and things like this. But what for? What can you achieve with that beyond killing a person? You see, the Russians are advancing. They are gaining territory. They are gaining some kind of power somehow. They are improving their situation. They are improving their military situation. They are improving their political situation. In addition to that, we have to see that the Russians, as opposed to the Ukrainians, have developed a real diplomacy during this conflict, because they were facing the threat of being isolated. Therefore, they use their diplomacy in order to break the political encirclement, to break the political isolation, and they succeeded in that. They were they were instrumental in developing the BRICS, the payment system in the BRICS, the various initiatives in the BRICS. They are present as, or they propose at least, their mediation in the conflict between Iran and the United States, in the Palestinian conflict, and so on. So meaning that the Russians have not stayed inactive diplomatically. Therefore, they've gained credibility. And the whole narrative that surrounded the war, with all the censorship that you have in the West regarding the start of the conflict, in fact, today they have proved let's say, negative against Ukraine, because that proved that Ukraine had something to hide as to how the conflict started. And censorship, when you censor something, that means you have something to hide. There's something you're not proud of. And that's exactly what happened. And that today is working in favor of Russia. And that's probably the reason why you have countries such as China, India, and so on, who refuse to condemn Russia. Even if the occupation of a country, of a neighboring country and all that could be a problem that could affect India or China adversely, and probably they are not in favor of that, basically. But the thing is that the conflict as it is today, where it is more and more obvious that Ukraine was used as a proxy, and remember, this is not what I say, it's what Marco Rubio said, that this had the Ukraine conflict was in fact a proxy conflict between United States and Russia, meaning that this very point that Russia was in fact constrained to intervene in Ukraine is something that today attracts sympathy for Russia. And I think that because the West tried with every effort to isolate Russia, to demonize Russia and all that, it has made Russia not only attractive, but it attracted some sympathy from the rest of the world. And today the West is isolated. If you add to this, you started this program with the interview of Trump. Now, if you add to all this, the behavior of Trump that use sanctions and tariffs and you name it, just in order to impose the view of the United States, and all that make the West look extremely bad. And when you put everything together, the West supporting Israel in everything it does, by the way, without condemning attack against Iran, against the Palestinians, I mean, the violation of human rights, the violation of the international law, and all that, all this. And you see all these developments that increase the sympathy for those who have the courage and the determination to fight against the West. And therefore, Russia is far from being isolated today. It has gained a lot of support from the international community. It's probably symbolic from this kind of resistance that is materialized in some way by the BRICS. Not this active or aggressive opposition against the West, but this kind of defensive opposition against the West, trying to escape the domination, escape this kind of hegemony of the West that dictates what is good or what is not good. ICC is good when it condemns Putin. It's not good when it condemns Netanyahu. Even if the crimes of Putin have never been demonstrated, while those of Netanyahu have been demonstrated by multiple international agencies. So all that, in fact, at the end of the day, works against the West, against Israel, against the United States. If you add all this misbehavior that we have in the West, everything adds up in a West that is corrupt, that has no morality, that has no respect for international law. And I remind you that international law, I mean the modern international law that came out of World War II, was precisely to avoid discretionary behavior of some countries, that in that case it was Nazi Germany, but in order to have kind of a a norm, a legal norm for assessing situation, for acting on the international stage. By moving the limits of this norm, as the West is doing, we are simply destroying the international law. And we are destroying exactly the basis of what we have created and what we have made in order to prevent the resumption of war, discrimination, abuse, and everything we have seen during World War II. That was the basis for having international law. And now the Western countries are exactly those countries who destroy what they have built themselves. And you know, we are exactly in the situation, I think I mentioned that last week. By destroying this international law-based order, we have created our own rules, and we tend to impose our rules across the world. These rules are misused. They are misused in order to make life impossible in some countries. Today, we have seen, and that was exemplified by the letter sent by Donald Trump to the President Lula of Brazil regarding domestic situation in Brazil, about the tribunal, the judgment of President Bolsonaro. I don't know all the whereabouts of this. The thing is that you have now a country that tried to impose, I mean, the United States trying to impose its view on domestic policies in countries. And Trump has said, because probably the rationale behind this is because Brazil is one of the BRICS countries and very active in that. And the West, and Trump in particular, is trying to make the life of BRICS countries impossible. Now, do you see the paradox? Because if, assuming you manage to make the life of BRICS impossible, you disrupt their economies and all that, what will happen? You will have exactly what we have done, not on the trade level, but in military level. You will make life impossible in those countries. And people, what do they do when the life is impossible in their country? They migrate. And they will migrate where? Where they think there might be some money to earn. So they will come to the West. And what is the biggest problem in the West? We just said before that now we want to distract money from social pensions and welfare and health system to defense. Now, if we have more refugees, more migrants and all that, I mean, that will not improve the situation. We are back into a situation where we're just creating additional problems to ourselves. So there is absolutely no interest of the West trying to increase or deepen the divide between the West and the rest of the world. I don't see the rationale behind this. This is the total lack of rationality. We have people who are, as I said, intellectually challenged, who lead these European and Western countries at large, by the way. So that's where we are.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. Thank you so much, Carl, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.